listening to the Red Seat Podcast, part of the Over the Monster Network.
Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champions.
Hosted by Jake Devereaux.
It's gone. It's into the bullpen. This game is tied. This game is tied. David Ortiz.
And featuring Keaton DeRosier.
It's a grand slam. I'm telling you.
This is Jake Devereaux. I just wanted to let you guys know before you listen to this podcast that it was recorded on Monday night. However, we had some technical difficulties with our recording software and we weren't able to download the episode until today. So today is Thursday night. So the first part of this podcast, we'll be talking about previewing the Yankees series. Obviously, that series did not go as we planned it to, but the rest of the podcast still remains very relevant. It's myself and Bob Osgood talking about the Red Sox roster and bullpen and a bunch of other good stuff, including the new ranking of the Red Sox system by Baseball America. So I hope you enjoy the episode. Apologize about the delay, and enjoy listening. Thank you very much. Welcome back to the Red Seat Podcast. This is your host, Jake Devereaux, and today joining me for episode 228 of the show is Bob Osgood. Bob, what's going on, man?
Jake, not much. It's been a while. How you doing, man?
Doing well. Doing very well. Excited to have you on the show. I think, is this your first time on this show in particular?
I did one with Keaton about a month back. Okay. While you were out for a week or two. So this is the first Jake and Bob Red Seat. So I'm very excited. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. We're happy to have you. For those of you who listen to this show and are unfamiliar with Bob, Bob hosts the Red Sox On Deck podcast here at Over the Monster. So focusing on minor league prospects with Shelley Verstrate over there. It's a great podcast. If you want to listen to that one, all you have to do is subscribe to this podcast, and you'll get that other one in your feed, too. So just check it out. You can also find Bob's work at The Dynasty Guru, and you can find him at Over the Monster. He's a writer there as well. So, Bob, let's get into it today, what we're going to talk about. We have a whole bunch of stuff to cover. We have some roster moves that have been made by the Red Sox, so we're going to discuss those. We're going to discuss where they sit in the standings after this last week. Keaton and I talked quite a bit about how the sky was falling last time, so things are a little bit better now. And then we'll get into listener questions and talking about the bullpen a little bit. So let's start right off. Since last week's podcast, the Red Sox played a frustrating series against the Tampa Bay Rays before sweeping the lowly Baltimore Orioles. They're 4-2 since we last recorded the show. As just a Red Sox fan, Bob, what is your temperature level with this team right now? I assume that it was, well, we texted. It was through the roof last time we talked. But how are you feeling about this club right now?
Yeah, I think over the last week, they did what I expected them to do. They went 4-2, home against the Rays and against Baltimore. I think they took care of business, which was good to see against Baltimore, but that team is just a mess, and I would have been disappointed for anything short of a sweep at home. I think earlier in the year I might have been hoping for 5-1, but just off of the 2-week stretch that they had just had, and my temperature on the On Deck pod where I went on about a 10-minute rant the other day, I think I've cooled off a little bit since that. It's good to see some wins. It's good to see the offense going. They scored 20, 16, and 8 in 3 of those wins. So I have, fewer sky is falling concerns than I did a week ago, especially with some of the big hitters in the lineup like JD and Xander specifically, who I think look healthy and back to themselves. So I feel confident about that. We had a certain left-handed pitcher that came back too. So feel slightly better than I did a week ago.
Yeah, it's amazing what adding Chris Sale and Kyle Schwarber can do to, lower the temperature in the room as it comes to freaking out about your baseball team. Still felt like, though, watching both of those series, that the Red Sox left a whole lot of runs on the table in both of those series. But in particular, you know, against Baltimore, it felt like some of those games should have been, you know, 9-1 after three innings or something like that, with you know, the amount of runners that were still being stranded, with runners in scoring position, even bases loaded situations. There were a whole lot more squanders than I wanted, even with the success that they were able to have.
Yeah, and that's been going on for about 2.5 to 3 weeks now, for sure. I think that looking at the schedule, I mean, hopefully they can beat up on some of these teams that are just like Baltimore. You know, you see Texas coming up. There's more games with Baltimore remaining. Obviously, there's a huge three-game set that's coming up here, but definitely still seeing some runners left on base. And as a whole, you know, over the last 3 weeks, there's, you know, both with some of the roster management that I'm sure we'll talk about, as well as the runners in scoring position, there's a lot of improvement that they still need to make, for sure.
Yep, a lot of stuff they can do better. Let's get into that upcoming series, though. So the Red Sox sit in the standings 3 games behind the Rays for first place. That's pretty good. Feeling better about that. But they're still just 2.5 games ahead of the Yankees and 4.5 up on the Jays. Red Sox are starting a very important series against the Yankees on Tuesday. There's a doubleheader on Tuesday, and then there's a third game on Wednesday. Pitching matchups seem pretty favorable for the Red Sox in this one. So they've got Eovaldi versus Gill. They have Houck versus Montgomery. And Nick Pivetta versus Andrew Haney. How do you see this matchup going between the Red Sox and Yankees over these 2 days?
Yeah, I think it's a slight favor to the Red Sox. You know, they've had the Yankees number overall this year, and they haven't seemed intimidated playing in Yankee Stadium, but it's certainly a different team that we're going to see. The Pivetta-Heaney matchup does not worry me on Wednesday. I think Heaney has not looked good all year. He's looked pretty terrible overall in New York in a couple of those starts. I feel good any game that Houck is throwing at this point, but Montgomery has pitched well against the Red Sox in a couple of games this year too. And then the new guy, Gill, or Heel, I think is how he pronounces it, has had two awesome starts. I don't know if he's given up a run yet. And I think that matchup against Eovaldi is going to be great. So I think the doubleheader, especially you throw the seven-inning wrinkle into things, which might be better, actually, the game that Houck throws, if they can get him. That shortens the game with him throwing in the doubleheader. Yeah. I think they can split tomorrow, being Tuesday, and take the Pivetta versus Heaney game on Wednesday. I do think they can win 2 out of 3, but, you know, it's a different New York team than what we've seen this year.
Yeah, that's for sure. I agree with you, though, that those first two pitching matchups are a lot closer than maybe they look on paper. And yeah, I guess Gil pronounces it Heel. That's really interesting. Eovaldi versus Heel, though, is going to be a kind of an interesting matchup. I'm looking forward to see the type of stuff that he has thrown against Eovaldi. So especially with the Red Sox bats not ever having seen him, it'll be interesting to see how they react to him. In Montgomery, you're right, has been tough all year long against the Red Sox. So, you know, if they can take those first two games, having Pivetta versus Haney would feel like a sweep is very much in hand.
Yep.
So, we'll see. Different, though, I mean, the Yankees, they are going to have Joey Gallo for this series, but he's been pretty bad, hitting under 200 since he's arrived for the Yankees. So that could be a good thing, or it could be meaning that he's due to actually cause some damage. But they will be without Anthony Rizzo, still on the COVID IL. I feel like that's a good thing. But then, well, Luke Voit's back in the lineup now. So, I mean, how worried are you about their offense? It seems like the Yankees' offense has been much better as of late.
Yeah, and in New York, even more so. Gallo is at a slow start for them, average-wise, but I still think he's going to be a beast there. I think a full season next year with a short porch, he could hit, I don't know, 45 home runs. I mean, the pop-up game-winning home run he hit last week, you know, I think if that was at Fenway and they were in the shift, that the second baseman might have gone back and caught it, and it went out to right to win the game. So I just think you're going to see a lot of crap like that. And, of course, he'll hit some tape measure shots as well, but they're a different team with a left-handed hitter like him there. And will be next year. With Rizzo, it sounds like he's going to work out on Tuesday, so I don't think we'll see him for the doubleheader. But could see him for one game on Wednesday, which will be an interesting dynamic because Schwarber will be in the lineup, and Rizzo, if he's back on Wednesday, that's going to be a really interesting game with both teams at full strength.
Yeah, that is going to be really interesting. I still feel like Rizzo would have been the right move for this club, but I am convinced Schwarber's the better hitter at this point in their careers. I haven't gotten to talk to you about that, the Red Sox not making the move to pay up and get Rizzo. Were you in favor of them adding Rizzo to this team, or do you like the fact that they went out and got the better hitter in Schwarber?
Yeah, that was the name I kept landing on, and if I knew... I didn't think they were going to go over the luxury tax, so it seemed that that it was unlikely. But then when I saw that the Cubs were paying his salary and that it would be two prospects, you know, maybe that Aldo Ramirez plus a lesser prospect like New York had paid in return, that was the move for me, both offensively, defensively, in the clubhouse. And I just think a player who was initially with the Red Sox anyways kind of coming back, I just thought it was a perfect fit. Not to mention the 2 weeks that we could have fought at the beginning there, not expecting COVID or anything like that. Where could you have seen that coming, for Rizzo to be out for that entire time? But it just seemed like that was the player that they should have gone after, provided that Chicago was paying his salary.
Yeah, I'm in total agreement with you there. Hopefully Rizzo has used this time well to do his own research into whether or not he should be getting the COVID vaccine. So he's still on the fence after getting it twice. So one of the other wrinkles to this series is the Yankees bullpen. Back of their bullpen has been an absolute mess. You know, Aroldis Chapman down with injury, Zach Britton literally removing himself from the role. That could be a big X factor here, because a lot of these Red Sox-Yankees games tend to be kind of close at the end.
Yeah, I'm surprised that they don't just close with Chad Green. And I think of the Sunday night game where he wasn't against the Red Sox, I don't believe, but he threw three innings and got nine outs in about 25 pitches, it seemed like. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but I feel like they should just put Green in that role. They seem to like to have him bounce around, throw the most important outs, but just the end of the game has been a mess, and Britton's a bit of a mess, and you gotta like Loizaga as well, but he's the one that gave up the five runs in the no-hitter game against the Red Sox, so he's prone to blow-ups as well. Looks like Chapman might return later in the week. I don't know if it'll be within the series, but I think they should close with Green. But I think the Red Sox will have a rested bullpen. The Yankees are playing tonight in a makeup game, Monday night against the Angels. You know, the bullpen's pretty rested outside. I know Barnes threw an inning on Sunday, but he should be ready. Whitlock probably will only throw one game because they don't really go back-to-back with him, so he could throw either Tuesday or Wednesday. You know, I know Ottavino had a bit of an injury scare yesterday, so we'll see what ends up happening there. But I think the Sox have that bullpen aspect that could be really big in this series.
Yeah, I agree with you. Cora has been vocal lately as to saying at this point in the season he is open to using Whitlock in back-to-backs too, so we might even be able to see him in a rare back-to-back appearance depending on how things shake out. But, you know, his workload, it does worry me a little bit, coming off Tommy John surgery, so hopefully they'll continue to be conservative with him.
Yeah.
Josh Taylor, though, he's a guy who will not in all likelihood appear in this series against the Yankees. He's in COVID protocols right now. It doesn't mean a ton, but usually, I mean, we saw this happen with Jaron Duran and JD Martinez. They missed a couple games being in COVID protocols. So even if they end up coming back negative, Josh Taylor comes back negative, he still is in all likelihood going to miss this series.
Yeah, and exactly what you said there with Duran and Martinez, they were similar, and they missed maybe 2 days. So my hope would be that they can get him back at least for a game if it's just a contact tracing situation. But yeah, I mean, that's a key lefty. And with Darwinson on the IL, they don't have a whole lot from the left side when Taylor isn't there. So that would certainly be a big loss. Hopefully they can have him back for at least one game during the series if he, you know, turns out to be negative there.
So you're not a big Austin Davis guy?
you know, it's fine. You know, it's another arm, and it's not Hansel Robles, and it's not Matt Andrees. And he has an option, and, you know, I think that probably the Chavis trade, it was just kind of about that time for them to move on there, and had a little, I think they probably looked at the first and second base depth that they had there and felt that maybe they needed another arm, but I wouldn't say I'm counting on him down the stretch or in the playoffs or anything like that.
You know what? It makes me happier to see him come into games than it did Michael Chavis. So yeah,
to swing at three high fastballs and take a seat. I understand. I always rooted for Chavis, but I think the time had come.
Yeah, he was a much better interview than he was baseball player.
Right.
So, all right, let's get into who we're not going to see. We're not going to see Chris Sale during this series either. That's kind of an interesting thing. He made his debut against Baltimore. We're going to talk about that in a second. But first, I want to focus on the Sox decision to break him in the way that they did. So they chose to have him face Baltimore and line up against Texas on Friday, two bottom barrel teams with pretty poor offenses, rather than face Tampa Bay and then New York in this series, which he could have conceivably been lined up to do. What do you think about that decision from, you know, I don't know who went into making it, probably some combination of Cora, Sale, and baseball ops, but do you think it was the right decision?
Yeah, and I'd be surprised if Sale was in favor of throwing one more minor league start. I would even send it a week prior to that, Jake. He threw the Saturday before the Toronto series, and they had an opportunity to have him throw Friday the 6th against Toronto on 5 days rest, and then the 12th against Tampa the following Thursday on 5 days rest, not even just four, you would have had five with both of those, and then New York on the 18th on Wednesday. So he could have lined up for Toronto, Tampa, and New York, and instead he faced Scranton, Baltimore, and Texas, and just doesn't have the same weight for me. And even I ranted about this a little bit on the On Deck pod, so I apologize if anyone's hearing this twice, but even after they had lost 3-4 games at the beginning of that disastrous stretch, you can change course. You know, he didn't need to ride through the hills on the bus and go to the AAA game, which I'm sure was a great experience for those minor leaguers, but we could have used that intensity and leadership with the big league club at that point. He threw 90 pitches in his last minor league game. I would rather he had thrown 90 pitches against Toronto in that first game and then seen Tampa and New York. And those are just three huge division games that, you know, you're four out behind the Rays in the loss column. You're only one in the loss column ahead of New York. Toronto's dropped off a little bit, but obviously we saw what happened there. Like, there was not enough urgency in bringing him back, and he had still thrown five minor league appearances, and he was up to 90 pitches, and it was time to go, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think if you asked Chris Sale what he would have preferred to do, you know, you would have got the answer that you predicted, that he would have liked to face all those teams. I think in this instance, if I had to guess why this decision was made, it's just to protect Chris Sale from himself.
Yeah.
They didn't want him probably going out and overthrowing and, you know, coming out and throwing 99 on the first fastball, you know, against Vlad Jr. or something like that. I get it, but from a fan standpoint and from needing these games, needing these division games, I totally agree with you. I was disappointed that they didn't bring him back when they had the opportunity to a little bit earlier. But, you know, on the positive side of things, when he did pitch against Baltimore, I thought he looked really good. In particular, I thought his fastball looked pretty solid. Change up, he had a good feel for it, which was nice to see. That's, you know, not always the case when you're off for an extended period of time. And then the slider was vintage for me. So I'm curious to see how he looked to you.
Yeah, and that last part, the slider, I mean, it was just great. And he was getting called strikes with it and a ton of movement on it. And, yeah, I mean, his fastball was not topping out at some of the numbers that we'd seen in the minor league guns. I think he was closer to 94, 95, at least in the portion of the game that I was watching. But the slider looked great. You know, he missed spots a little bit, and I think that that's to be expected in the first season coming back. I think his command will be even better next year. You know, gave up a couple of home runs, which was fine. They were both solo shots. He didn't walk anybody. That was the most important thing. And, yeah, I was very happy with what I saw. And I don't know, sale day is back. You know, when you see that on the schedule, you're watching. And I just, that feeling on Saturday, I went out of my way to make sure I was in front of a TV for the first inning when sale was back, you know, on a summer weekend. Just, you have to make it happen. And it's just, it's a totally different feeling. And you could tell with, in the post game, the way that he was talking, you know, that this game had been taken away from him for 2 years, and he had a hole in his chest, and all the things that he was saying. It's just like, the other guys in the locker room are going to be hearing that, and they've got their leader back, at least on the staff in the rotation.
Yeah, I think the attitude he brings to the team is infectious, even to the position players. So it's a huge lift to get a guy like that back. What did you think about I think it was the first home run that Sale allowed when Vasquez called back-to-back changeups in that at-bat. Did you think that that was questionable by Vasquez? Or, I mean, what was your thought on that?
Yeah, I guess I hadn't thought about it. I don't know. I trust Vasquez back there is what it comes down to. And I feel that he is a really experienced, smart catcher. I mean, maybe that's the kind of thing that he hasn't worked with him in a couple of years, and it's a learning experience. And hey, you had the learning experience in a 6-0 game against Baltimore, and not in October. But I hadn't really thought too much into it, and I trust the game that Vasquez calls.
Yeah, I think Eck was freaking out a little bit about it. So
I had that one on mute. I did catch Eck yesterday when he was on fire, just royally offended by both the umpires and the pitching staff of the Baltimore Orioles that. You don't want to come out throwing salad and missing your spots with Eck calling the game. He was extra fired up on Sunday. So,
well, he's got to have it. He's got to have all of them.
Yeah, they had a couple 3-run Johnsons yesterday that he was pretty excited about. So,
yeah, I always I like when Eck's in the booth because my favorite thing is pair of shoes, man.
Yeah, I got to have it. It's great. I mean, I think he still mentally is on the mound when these games are happening.
Oh, totally. Yeah, he's like a little kid up there in the booth. He's great.
Fantastic.
So moving on from Chris Sale here, we have an old friend coming back to Boston. Some of you might say we buried the lead here. Travis Shaw, mayor of Ding Dong City, was claimed off waivers from the Brewers. He's a lefty bat that can play first base. Where do you think he fits with this team? He was activated today. Corresponding moves, two moves that happened. Wong was sent down, and then also Franchy Cordero, who just never really got it going this year, was sent down as well. So clearly they're expecting to give Shaw some playing time.
Yeah, it's a depth move, and it's also, I think it's fresh in our head that Dahlbeck played so well last week. But he has these great weeks and these off weeks, and I don't know. I mean, Shaw's hitting 191 this year. I'm not expecting him to come in and you know, dominate or anything like that. He's got a WRC plus of 68, but he might be a little bit rejuvenated, at least for a week or two, coming back to Boston where he liked to play, has some history there. I think new Cora from growing up when his father was in the clubhouse with Cora. So I think it's worth a shot. I mean, these other experiments aren't working, whether it's Cordero or Marwin, who we've moved on from, or Santana. It's just, and we obviously Arroyo isn't going to be able to play first. He went about 3 innings doing that. So I'm fine with it, especially because it's a left-handed bat. I'm not expecting a ton. I'm expecting to start maybe once or twice a week until they can. And if they give Schwarber a shot playing first base, but you know, the rosters are going to expand in a couple of weeks, and it's just giving someone else a shot here because the other things weren't working out. So I don't hate it. I don't have my high expectations though.
Yeah, I'm with you. I have some serious questions about whether he's got anything left. I think if he does have anything left, you know, this is the best place for him to extract that performance, considering all the good feels that he did have when he was here. He does say that he's healthy now. I guess he had some injury issues over the last few years. But, you know, I went back and I pulled the numbers from 2019 and through this season so far. And over 652 plate appearances, he has just 19 home runs and a slash line of 191, 287, 331. 331 is the thing that shocked me. You don't usually think of Travis Shaw and think of a 331 slugging percentage. That comes out to just a 66 WRC plus over the last three seasons. So, you know, it's a pretty low bar to clear. But the interesting thing is it's still, you know, at times been better than what Dahlbeck has been giving you. So right. That's kind of crazy. But he does only have a 71 WRC plus against right-handed pitchers this season, which I was surprised about, because you think if he's coming in here left-handed bat, you'd be looking for him to kind of come in and do damage against righties and hold down that position defensively. But yeah, it kind of opens up more questions to me about where Schwarber's going to play too, if you're bringing in a guy like Shaw. You know, how much are you expecting him to be at first base?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, he like I said, I think it's just another option, and they couldn't let the Cordero experience go any longer. And he has a decent glove and has some versatility. He's played some third base and some second base in the past, so it's a depth move, and maybe you catch lightning in a bottle for a week or two, either this month or next month, or gets a clutch Mitch Moreland three-run homer in October or something like that. But yeah, I'm with you. The numbers against right-handed pitching are not impressive either, so could just be kind of a last-ditch shot for the 31-year-old.
Yeah. I mean, I'm rooting for him. I hope I hope he comes in and hits like 350 over the last month and turns into, you know, vintage Travis Shaw. But not expecting a lot from him, but it's a cool story nonetheless. Yeah. Speaking of Milwaukee, though, where he was from, where he came from, they'll play just about anybody at second base over there. It's like a beer league softball team with Julio Urrola at second base. So I don't know if I can give him credit for second base in Milwaukee.
Yeah, right. That's that's an emergency move for sure.
Yeah, but maybe he's got at least the athleticism of Michael Chavis. I'm really bagging on Chavis this episode.
I know. Sorry. Do you want to bag on Hansel Robles instead?
I would like to. Okay. Yeah. So let's talk about him. Is it true that his nickname is Big Fudge?
Is it true that he comes out to the Undertaker theme song?
I don't know. Is it
yes.
True?
Yeah, that's what he's been coming out to. You need to have better stuff than Hansel Robles to come out to the Undertaker theme song in Fenway Park. I'm sorry.
What the hell does Big Fudge mean?
I don't know. No, I'm afraid to Google it.
Yeah, I don't understand. I don't understand anything about Hansel Robles. That's the thing. Like, he's come into this pen, and I was thinking to myself, and when we made this move, I talked to Keaton on the pod, and I'm like, okay, there must be some analytical thing that we're not seeing. Like, trying to think, Austin Bryce, like last year, Austin Bryce. Oh, his fastball plays up on TrackMan data. Oh, okay, cool. What is it about Hansel Robles? Because he's come into games, and I've just been like, this guy's stuff is awful. Yeah. Like, he just doesn't have it anymore. So, I mean, let's talk about Mr. Fudge here. How is this guy still in the bullpen at this point with all the moves that they've been making? I don't see it.
So, I do just want to help you out. Austin Davis is Big Fudge.
Oh, okay. Thank goodness.
Yeah. So, I had the guts to Google that. And it said, for Mass Live, the Red Sox traded the Ice Horse for Big Fudge, is the headline. So, that was Austin Davis.
How did he get the name Big Fudge?
It said that his friends back home call me that. And
I bet there's a really gross story we don't want to know about why he's called Big Fudge.
It's like something having to do with him breaking a chair. All right, we'll look at this later. I think Hansel Robles is here. I don't know if they start a brawl, possibly. I mean, he in one outing gave up 3 hits and 3 runs, and then the next outing gave up 3 hits and 2 runs, and then in the outing after that, he walked 3. I know he gave up a walk-off grand slam in the outing before he was traded here. I don't see him on any kind of playoff roster, whether it's for 1 game or 5 or 7 games. I just don't see the Undertaker theme song being on at Fenway in October, personally. I don't know what you think.
I really hope not. Yeah. It hasn't been good. There are going to be, you know, some other bullpen arms that are going to be available soon. Ryan Brazier is rehabbing currently at AAA Worcester. Stats have not lived up to the name so far for him. Pulling it up right now. He's got an ERA somewhere north of 12 right now for that club. Let's just see here. Went too far. Here it is. Yeah, 2 2/3 innings, 27 ERA so far. So he has not exactly been lights out for Worcester. Bizardo not eligible to come up to the club until September 3rd because he's on the 60-day. An interesting name that I didn't put on the agenda is Alex Claudio, who was actually claimed off of waivers from the Angels. He threw an inning and a third clean for Worcester. I'm actually kind of intrigued by him as well. And Matt Andrees has pitched pretty well in August. 4 innings, no earned runs, 0.75 whip for Worcester. Yaxel Rios is down there now as well. I mean, how does this all shake out in your mind? What's the best bullpen? Put together the best bullpen for me.
Yeah, so, and this kind of goes along with, we should talk about Richards and Perez too, right?
Yeah.
I guess I'll ask you that first. Are Richards and Perez both in your ideal bullpen?
I need more data before I can answer it, but yeah. I will say I have been intrigued by Richards and Perez out of the pen. Both of their stuff has looked better out of the pen than it has as a starter. And I think that there is a lot to the whole the best relievers are failed starters thing. And I kind of, you know, I'm more optimistic. After seeing Richards in that 3-inning save versus Baltimore, I'm kind of thinking that those guys might work out. And, you know, why not have a guy who has three or four pitches out of the pen, gives you more stuff that you're able to go to in those shorter stints. So, yeah, I guess I'd rather have those guys than any of these questionable bullpen arms.
Yeah. And I'm kind of giving you a half answer here because a month ago I would have said that only one of them should be in the bullpen. But now that we're at August 17th, we're 2 weeks away from the rosters expanding to 28. And they have 2 days off this week, and they have 1 day off next week, and then that brings you to that September 1st date. So I think at this point, with what they're paying them and being that close to adding 2 names to the roster to get to 28, I think they're going to keep both of them. So I'm kind of going with a 14-man staff in September, right, that needs to be cut down. And you got your 5 starters and Hauk being the 5th.
Yeah.
So I put 9 names down for September, which is kind of cheating, but I'm more looking at that, which will tell us a lot about October. So I got Barnes, Whitlock, Taylor, Ottavino, Salamora, Perez, and Richards. So that's 7.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got Darwinson or Davis as your 3rd lefty, as the 8th. And then the 9th is Brazier, Claudio, and Robles. So I would say if Darwinson's healthy, that's your 3rd lefty for me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I'd take him over Davis, too, just because the stuff plays better in the playoffs.
Yeah. And then, I don't know. I mean, if Brazier's got a 27 ERA, then you can't go with him. But I guess for September, I would hope that he's the ninth arm, but probably wouldn't. I would probably cut him off for October.
I weirdly feel more confident about Ryan Brazier and Claudio than I do Hansel Robles at this point.
And there's Rios, too. Forgot. Rios was in that four righties.
Yeah.
Brazier, Claudio, Robles, Rios, one of those.
Yeah, I'm kind of... Part of me is like, well, I get wanting to preserve the bullpen depth here and give yourself the most options. And, you know, like you mentioned, rosters are going to expand coming up here. But I felt like Rios deserved to stay in the bullpen.
Yeah.
I think the only reason he got sent down is because you can't send down Robles, you can't send down Perez, you can't send down Richards. Those are all guys you'd have to DFA.
Right.
So.
Yeah, no, I think that was just simply a roster crunch. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he throws 100 some nights. He looks really good. So, yeah, I mean, I'd be totally fine with him as that last arm, at least for September. And then you talk to me in a month, and we'll reevaluate if it's a one-game or a five-game playoff that we're looking at and what kind of a roster you're putting together for that.
Yeah, that does change a lot of things. What was your impression of Richards and Perez out of relief? Did you like one more than the other? How did you think their stuff looked?
Yeah, Richards did look good the other night out of the bullpen. I was glad that he kind of took that role and went with it and came out and pitched confidently. I mean, he was pretty efficient in those three innings. I would give a slight edge to him. I thought it was interesting when Cora sent Perez to the bullpen. He just sent him back out there the next... He started one day and then pitched in relief the next day, which you don't get taken out of the rotation and then pitch in the bullpen the next day too often. I think Richards looked a little bit better, but I don't know. I could see Perez, when he's pitching well, looking pretty good one time through the lineup. But you got to get him out. I mean, if he looks bad for three hitters, you got to get him out of there because he can blow up so quickly and I think can have, you know, quicker blow up than Richards could.
Yeah, he relies too much on called strikes for me to really like him in a relief role. So I do have to go with Richards there. My concern with Richards, though, and I've stated this a bunch on this podcast, so I apologize if I'm repeating this for you guys, but, you know, I know he didn't take well to the news of being demoted to the bullpen, and he very much thinks of himself as a starting pitcher. So I worry about his presence becoming a little bit cancerous in that clubhouse if, you know, he decides one day he doesn't really like his role.
Yeah, well, they should show him his whip, and maybe he'll change his mind.
Yeah, just bring out the stats. Yeah. All right, just here we go.
One page printout here, sir.
All right. Well, that about does it for our main topics of the night. But we do have a bunch of great listener questions that we are going to get to right now. Our first comes from Gavin Blackburn. You're the perfect guy to have on for this question, Bob. He says, today's Baseball America farm system rankings at 9 still includes Durant. How far do you think they fall when he's no longer a prospect, assuming he stays up enough to no longer qualify? So he should graduate this year, or at least come very close. I think he will graduate because of when they called him up. But that's a good question. Right now, he ranks second on the list of Baseball America's top 30, just ahead of Marcelo Meyer. Where would you have this group of players without Jaron Duran in it?
Yeah, and I think it's 45 days of service, so he'll probably, in a couple of weeks, drop off of that list. So they're ninth, and they've made a lot of progress from a year ago, where they were in the lower half. I think you saw a lot of 18th to 20th range, and it sucks losing Aldo. He was my guy, and they've lost a lot of pitchers to arm injuries that are still in the system and long term hopefully will be involved, but some of those pitching injuries hurts, and I would feel a little better about this going forward if it wasn't for, you know, Ward and Mata, and, you know, part of the year with Siebold missing with the arm injury, and Bizardo was hurt a lot of the year, and there's just hasn't been a ton of consistency with the pitchers.
Yeah.
But they just added, in my opinion, the best prospect in the draft in Marcelo Meyer. He'll slide in nicely right where Duran was on the list. You know, that probably incorporated Meyer as well. But you throw that with Cassius and Gilberto Jimenez and Houck still being a prospect. And I've just, with York and Groom and Blaze Jordan, who have all gotten off to some, I don't want to say good starts because it's August already, but have been playing really well. I have, and Bayo, of course,
you know, yeah, playing big in the futures there. Game.
So there are some injuries, and we're going to talk about one other prospect, Mr. Downs, towards the end of this as well, that has been slightly disappointing. But I feel that they're just in way better shape in the minor league system than they were. And I still think, to answer your question, I still think they would be in the top half, you know.
Yeah.
12th. Something around that range, even losing Duran.
I agree with you, and I think that it does have to do with the selection of Mayer. Definitely the breakout of Bayo. Nick York just being an absolute beast over the last like month and a half of hitting. He's just been incredible. One of the better pitchers. Really justifying that selection that the Red Sox took him at 2 years ago. So that really looks, they're looking very smart. Blaze Jordan, I really like that you pointed him out, because that was a guy who I really didn't believe in very much, and he's been gangbusters since he started. And then, but just little depth names that the Red Sox have been able to acquire: Winkelmann Gonzalez, Josh Winkowski, guys like that. Chi-Jung Liu, who we don't know a ton about, but like is an interesting arm. Jeremy Wu Yelland, pitching well, still with some control issues. But like all of those guys are just those depth moves that have paid off from Bloom. And we're still waiting on some of the guys from the international class that we don't know a ton about. Miguel Blaise, Brandon Bonacci, we want to see him play more. But yeah, there's a lot more meat here, and this is one of the reasons why I was a little bit critical of Bloom's deadline, is because you know, you could have dealt from guys 11 through 30 in this system and still went out and added some significant pieces.
Yep. Yeah, I mentioned earlier, I don't know what the exact equivalent would be in a Rizzo deal. But I did feel, and I know he's trying to sustain some long-term success, wants to have, you know, a Dodgers system that can replenish whenever you have an injury, and it takes time to do that. Well, unfortunately, we were a year ahead of the plan, and you need to adjust a little bit, and I do wish they made one more move from the top 30 prospects, and I still think they would have been in good shape here.
If you offer Aldo, Lugo, and Potts for Rizzo, yeah, I think that's just as good, or not better, than the package that the Cubs got from the Yankees.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that would be very similar.
Yeah. All right, good question there. Our next question comes from Jason Crane, and he says, this is not Sox related, and I could probably just Google it. True. But are there any MLB teams left that have never been good? So many of these classic curses have been broken. Examples, the Cubs and the Sox. I think he probably means both the Red Sox and the White Sox, because the White Sox was actually, what was it, like 96 years when that was broken in 2005, so that was a long one. I think the longest drought right now goes to the Cleveland baseball team, the future Cleveland Guardians. I think that's at like 50-something years.
Yeah.
I mean, who would be on your list of teams for this question?
Yeah, that was one of them. 1948, and just an absolute turning point for two franchises in that rain delay in Game 7 between the Indians and the Cubs. One of the great non-Red Sox but baseball experiences I've ever had is watching that game and just knowing, as a MLB history guy, which I know you are as well, Jake, just two franchises that were at a fork in the road right there. You know, they go into a rain delay going into extra innings in Game 7, and the Cubs pull it out. So yeah, that Indians/Guardians 1948 being the last title that they had, that's the first one that came to mind for me. The other one is the Mariners. Now, they've never won a title. They haven't been around as long. I want to say maybe the 70s. But they also haven't made the playoffs since 2001. And I don't know what's worse, if you're an Indian/Guardians fan that for seven decades hasn't seen a title, or the Mariners not making the playoffs for 20 years and not having a title in those 40 years. Those are the first two that come to mind for me. And it irritates me every time I see the Mariners not totally going for it when they have a good team. I mean, they had that Ichiro team that won 110 or so games in the early 2000s and couldn't win a title with that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you came to that conclusion too, because the other team that I was going to mention is the Mariners, so we were on the same wavelength there. I actually think it would be much worse to be a Mariners fan than it would be to be an Indians fan or a Guardians fan or whatever.
Yeah.
Guardians. Let's go with Guardians.
We'll go with that.
But, you know, the reason why is just you don't have the rich history that the Cleveland franchise has with some of the better players in all of baseball. You know, Knapp, Lajoie from way back. Then they also had Tris Speaker, who was great with the Red Sox. I mean, they've had some amazing pitchers there. They've had a lot of historic success. And then you couple that with the fact that the Mariners, man, they had some loaded teams. Like Griffey, Randy Johnson, Edgar Martinez. You telling me all those guys together couldn't win anything? It's just like, it's torture thinking about how good the talent that has been in Seattle and not won anything has been.
They went 116-46. And it's lost crazy. In five games in the ALCS to New York. That's the last time that they made the playoffs.
That is just brutal.
Yeah, those Hall of Famers that you're mentioning there, Ichiro, Edgar, Griffey wasn't on that team anymore, but you throw that out there, Randy Johnson. That team was an absolute wagon, and they haven't made the playoffs. 116 to not being back. Is just mind-blowing. So I'm with you. I'd rather be a Cleveland fan, and Cleveland had those other near misses as well in the 90s with your Manny, Tome, Alomar, Bell teams that were a little looper up the middle off of Charlie Nagy's glove within another World Series. So they've had some heartbreaks, but I'd rather that. I'd rather have some interesting games in memorable playoff games than just not being there.
Yeah, I mean, any Cleveland fan that is listening to this podcast by chance is just screaming at us right now.
I know.
Especially if they're our age, because 95 losing 4-2 to the Braves in that series, then losing in 7 in 97 to the Marlins of all teams, and then losing again in 2016 in the best baseball game I think I've ever seen.
Yeah,
it's just craziness. So yeah,
well, we're happy to be your Google, Jason.
Yes. Yeah, we're much more fun than Google. Next question comes from Zangarang. He says, sales return this past Saturday has gotten me thinking about the playoffs. Come October, if the standings end up how they are now, we make it to a wild card. Who starts in the wild card game? Would you trust Sale, Eovaldi, one of those other starters with Whitlock or Hauk piggyback? It's a really interesting question. Who would be your go-to guy in a one-game playoff?
Yeah, and if the rotation lines up, right, you didn't need to use one of those pitchers on Saturday and Sunday to get into that wild card game. If you got rotation lining up, I'm going to go with Sale if he looks like himself. You know, I've got Whitlock ready for 7-9 outs and hope Sale gets to the sixth inning. And, you know, in a one game, I just want to use Sale, Whitlock, Barnes, and hope that that's enough.
Yeah, I'm with you. As much as I like the way Eovaldi's pitched this year, it's just not comparable to Sale when he's on. So
yep.
That's my guy who I'm riding with. And if you have the luxury to have the choice between Sale and Eovaldi for that game, you know, if something looks off with Sale, you're going to Eovaldi because there is no tomorrow.
Yep.
So, yeah. Good question, though. Cody Hudman has our next question. How much playing time do we think Shaw will get? Maybe spelling Bobby D every once in a while when Bobby D is not hot. Straight platoon when he cools off. I think that's an interesting question. You were saying maybe one time a week. I think he might play maybe a little more than that, maybe a couple times a week. This kind of goes to the... I mean, I just don't think Bobby Dalbec's as good as people think he is. Even after this like hot streak this past week, I am just still not impressed by so many of his at-bats.
Yeah, and when he's slumping, it is infuriating to see the 0-for-4 with 3 Ks, and I love rooting for the guy, and I loved watching this weekend, you know. Double dong on Sunday, or Saturday, the 16-2 win. And I mean, you know he's got 40 homer pop.
Sure.
But he strikes out 36% of the time, and if you combine the month last year, 38% of the time since he's been in the league, and I'm just not convinced that that is the full-time first baseman for the rest of the year. So, yeah, no. I think 2 days a week is fair. I just don't know that it's Shaw that starts 2 days a week. You know, I think it could be some other players that they potentially work in, and we see what happens with Schwarber when he is healthy enough to give that a shot, which it sounded at least initially like he was open to doing.
Yeah, definitely. It makes the roster a lot easier to figure out how to optimize it if you can get Schwarber's bat over at first base.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm tending to lean with you that Dalbec's going to have to make major changes if he wants to be a viable, close to everyday guy. You know, in that series against the Orioles, as good as he played, he still struck out with the bases loaded. And he does that just way too often for my liking.
Yep.
Angel Rondon has our next question. He says, is Kike Hernandez the second best signing of the offseason, behind Marcus Semien, of course, who got a one-year deal? That's an interesting question. Marcus Semien's had an amazing season. Kike Hernandez has had an on-base percentage over 400 for the last month out of the leadoff spot. He's been great, but, I mean, would he be the second best deal of the offseason for you?
It's really interesting, and I looked at it a little bit, and I think that you can make a reasonable case for it. I mean, Real Muto got a lot of money, but he's been good. You know, he's been worth the money that he got so far. There's a couple of players who had some off-the-field issues that have not been worth the contracts that they got. Desclafani was one for me. I know that he has, I mean, he's been an anchor for that staff in San Francisco, who has the best, you know, do they still have the best record in baseball? I believe they do.
They do, yeah.
Yes, yeah, 76 wins, which is just insane. And Desclafani was on the scrap heap, and I think was just a few million. So that was the only other one that I thought was close. I think Melanson, the closer in San Diego, went for pretty cheap, and he's been a good one-year signing as well. But, geez, Kike has been... looking at what he has done over the last 2 months, like, you know that he's been hot, but then you see some of it in print. I know that there's just been some tweets that have been going around recently to just show for how long he's been this hot for. So I think you can absolutely make the case for that.
Yeah, the other name that came to mind, and I know that on a dollar per dollar amount, this player definitely doesn't qualify for this, but, you know, you have to like the way that the George Springer contract looks for the Blue Jays, a team that, you know, clearly was trying to move into contention now. I think you could even make the case that the Robbie Ray signing by the Blue Jays is up there for one of the better ones. So the Blue Jays were absolutely on fire this offseason with the deals that they got done. So
you just they're have terrifying to look north over the border. Next 2-3 years. I mean, after the Berrios trade that they made, and that lineup is, this division is going to be fascinating for years.
Yeah, totally. Toronto scares the crap out of me. Jeff Wax has our next question. He says, should we sign Bartolo Colon? It's almost like he knew you were coming on the podcast.
What, do I have some sort of history there?
I think it's just, you know, you laughing at the Bartolo Colon gifs that get posted in the group chats that we're on that made me think that you'd like this one.
Well, do you remember how his tenure in Boston ended in 2008? Francona took him out of the rotation, and he just went home, and he didn't tell anybody. He just went back to the Dominican Republic and bounced. And that was in 2008 when he was 35 years old and seemingly at the end of his career, and after that pitched 10 more years, pitched till 2018 in Texas when he was 45 years old. I mean, it's just a fascinating baseball reference page if you are looking to kill 5 minutes at some point. But yeah, no, he was in Boston. He threw 39 innings here in 2008 and did not... He took the demotion worse than Garrett Richards did, let's put it that way, and just went home and didn't tell anybody.
That is amazing. Yeah, I totally blocked that out of my mind, I think because of the Rays, Red Sox... situation in 2008. I've tried to forget.
Yeah, it's not surprising that he couldn't make that rotation because that was arguably their best team in an absolute wagon. But yeah, let's not talk about that Rays series.
All right. Next question comes from Greg Drake. He says, any thoughts on BA moving the Sox farm system into the top 10? I would just say that, you know, my quick thoughts on it are that it's due. This is one of the things that we've been talking about on this show, and I'm sure you and Shelly have been talking about it on your show, is that, you know, this Red Sox farm system is good. I've been telling people that this is a top third farm system. So to finally see it get ranked as a top third farm system was really kind of gratifying to me.
Yeah. And all of just the small moves, and in some cases bigger moves, you know, think of Benintendi, which if you put his numbers against anyone in the outfield, you talk about Kike and you talk about Renfro and Verdugo, they haven't really missed a beat with that, as much as I didn't love the trade at the time. They got Winkowski out of that, and I think he is kind of creeping up some of the prospect lists and has looked pretty good overall, and they got some depth pieces in that deal. And you just go back to some of the smaller, you look at the Whitlock deal, who is no longer a prospect, but when he was on the list, in addition to that, you know, it looked even better. So just like small 40-man moves, the Moreland trade and the Hembry trade, bringing in Pivetta and Seabold, they really did some good things in a lost year that at the time probably, you know, weren't on the front page. But I think they slowly but surely have worked this thing up.
Yeah, and these are the moves that, when you look at them, separate Bloom from Dombrowski in the way that they operate. And I think that a lot of times when we talk about the comparison between Bloom and Dombrowski, we don't give Dombrowski enough credit for what his strengths are. You know, I think Dombrowski would have never had a deadline like Bloom had with a team that was, you know, competing for the division. He would have been much more aggressive, much more decisive. And that was the thing. Philly. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And we see that Phillies team charging, you know, towards the top of that division and challenging for a playoff spot. That part of being a GM is underrated. And I think that Bloom's talent of making moves around the fringes is also very underrated, but you need to appreciate both styles for sure. Yep. And we can't forget how many times Dombrowski has gotten it right with making that choice between, you know, do I trade Moncada or do I trade Devers? You know, he makes the right choice a lot of the time. So
Yeah, I think the last year that he was here kind of sticks out for people a lot, but, you know, flags fly forever and Dombrowski won a title and made some very good deals. But yeah, I think there's a sour taste towards the end for some people, myself included.
Yeah, totally. You merge both of them together and you get a perfect GM.
Right. Yep.
You get Farhan Zaidi or, you know, Andrew Friedman or one of those guys. So.
Yep.
Vegas Baby has our last question tonight. Is it time to have a very Brady conversation about Jeter Downs? Which is worse for his confidence, a demotion to Portland or continuing to run out nightly offers? He'd need a two-week hot streak just to sniff the Mendoza line at this point. Yeah, he has struggled, man. It's shocking. I hadn't really been paying attention to his numbers, and then I looked at his numbers today.
It's alarming.
It was crazy. So I have his updated line right here through today. 181, 270, 305 with a 575 OPS on the season over 259 at-bats. That is horrible.
Yeah. And it's getting worse is the part that concerns me. Because in his last 11 games, he's 2 for 37 with 19 Ks. And if you go, I don't know, we'll go back another 2 weeks. So since July 16th, a month ago, he's 8 for 82 with 35 strikeouts. That's an 0.98 average over the last 30 days.
Ugh.
So that's my concern, is that it's getting worse and the strikeout rate is getting worse. And what's more damaging, having him sit at home for months looking at a 180 average, or moving him down to double A at a level that he never really got to play at because of the pandemic, and maybe get on a hot streak and have that challenge and have a few weeks of putting the bat on the ball and hopefully go into the offseason with a positive? Because I'm just worried that he's going to go home with a 170 average and a 240 OBP and get trashed all offseason, and we've done irreparable damage here. And Shelley made this point a week ago on the pod, saying, like, is it time to do that? It hadn't even crossed my mind until she asked me that question on the On Deck last week. And I, you know, it's a valid point.
It is. It's just so taboo to do it in the minor leagues. You know, when you move a guy up a level, the thought is that if you move him down, you demote a guy, that is more confidence crushing than anything else.
Sure.
And basically saying to the guy, I don't think you can figure it out at this level. So that's the thing that worries me about it. I'd almost rather a IL stint for him, like a, you know, muscle strain or something like that, and have him just work in the cage and figure it out with the coaching staff at Worcester, and then maybe have a good last week of the season there. Than the demotion at this point. It's kind of where I'm at with him.
Yeah, and I certainly don't know the answer. No. But I can see both sides, and I don't know what that would do for his confidence one way or another. I mean, he really didn't. He's 23, so at 23, sending him down to double A, it's not like he would be crazy old for that level, and he played 12 games there, and you know, you hear that is just the most important level to master. And in hindsight, maybe sending him there for a month wouldn't have been the worst thing. But what's done is done.
Yep. The hay is in the barn, unfortunately.
There you go. Yeah.
All right. Well, that has been our show today. We hope that you've enjoyed this last hour of Red Sox baseball talk with myself and Bob. You can follow Bob on Twitter. Bob, where can they find you?
I'm at Bob Osgood 15 on Twitter.
All right, the 15th Bob Osgood on Twitter.
Right, Jake's at Big Fudge.
Yeah, I'm at Big Fudge. No, don't put that in your computer. I don't know what'll come up. But yeah, find me at Dev Jake. Find the Over the Monster site at Over the Monster. And check out the other shows on the network. I always plug these at the end of the show, but you know, if you haven't checked out Bob and Shelley on the Red Sox On Deck show, check out their work over there. Matt and Brian on the Over the Monster podcast, and then Heaton and Shelley on the Precap podcast. So thanks very much for joining us, Bob. Thank you, and we'll be with you again next week.